Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher, 8:06 on this Tuesday. It's March 12th. 31 degrees currently in Old Town Park City. On the phone with us from the ABC Forecast Center, meteorologist Thomas Keyboy. Good morning.
Morning, Leslie. Happy Tuesday to you. We got an active day ahead of us as our next storm system is going to be dropping in from the northwest as we move through today. We've already seen some showers move across northern Utah, but most of what we've seen has been confined to the mountains. But as we go through the next several hours, as our storm system gets closer and the moisture continues to fill in, that chance of wet weather will only be increasing. And as we go from the morning into the afternoon, we'll go from a 60% chance of seeing snow in Park City to roughly a 90% chance as we go from late morning through the afternoon. We'll see a daytime high of 40 in Park City, but I think for the most part, we'll mainly stay snow in Park City, while down in Heber, we could see times of rain and snow. And then as we move throughout this afternoon, as the cold front works its way in, there's even a chance now we could see some brief heavy precipitation and even can't rule out the potential for a few rumbles of thunder. So as you head out the door later today into and through this afternoon, don't be surprised if you hear those rumbles of thunder as that cold front works its way through. Tonight we'll be holding on to a decent chance of snow, roughly 80% chance before midnight, and then roughly a 50-50 chance during the overnight hours, with the overnight low falling to 24 degrees as the cold front will have passed by then. But even though the cold front will be moving from west to east, kind of out of our neighborhood for our Wednesday, lingering moisture and energy from the system that's driving all this will still be working its way through, and that's going to lead to another unsettled day for our Wednesday with a 70% chance of seeing snow. And with a northerly flow taking over, that daytime high tomorrow will only top out right around 32 degrees in Park City, with maybe mid-30s down in the Heber Valley. So we'll be looking at an active day today. We'll stay active through tonight into tomorrow. And I'm thinking between today and tomorrow, we could land anywhere between 2 to 6 inches and Park City itself, maybe 1 to 4 inches for Heber. And if everything comes together, there is the potential that we do pick up a little bit more snow out of this particular storm, and we'll see more snow for the mountains compared to what we're going to see down in Park City itself. On Wednesday night, we hold on to a 40% chance of snow, the overnight low dropping to 19 degrees, and we'll hold on to a slight chance for some snow showers on Thursday. But by Thursday into Friday, the system driving everything will start to migrate into the southern portion of the state. So by that point, central and southern Utah will be favored for showers. But in northern Utah, with our winds out of the east, it will be a little bit windy to close out the work week. Temperatures will begin to moderate. We'll be at 39 degrees on Thursday, dropping back to 19 degrees on Thursday night under partly cloudy skies. And then on Friday, we get mostly sunny skies with a daytime high of 40. So we're going to be feeling like late winter over the next several days based on those temperatures that we have. As we move into this weekend, we're going to start to crank up the spring feeling. On Saturday, Sunday, and likely into early next week, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, we'll all check in with mostly sunny to partly cloudy skies, and we will be warming up each day. On Saturday, the daytime high will come in at 45. The overnight low will drop to 24 on Saturday night. We'll likely be in the upper 40s on Sunday with a low in the mid-20s again. And by Monday, we could see a daytime high of 50 degrees, Leslie.
Wow. Okay. Thanks.
You're welcome.
And with a look at the backcountry on the phone with us from the Utah Avalanche Center, we have Drew Hardesty. Good morning.
Hey, good morning, Leslie. Generally low avalanche danger in the backcountry. I don't think that we're going to see enough snow during the day today to really pose much of a problem. As always, if things come in more rapidly with more wind, then just anticipate elevating avalanche danger. But I think we'll stick at low danger for today. You know, we have a great deal of uncertainty over how much snowfall is going to come in with this system. The models have pretty large spread in regarding the amount of snowfall that should come in this afternoon, tonight, and into tomorrow. But the flip side is what we do have a great deal of certainty about are the strong east winds that are on tap for Thursday into Friday, searing easterly winds. And I think that's going to be our most significant issue as we play out later in the week regarding our avalanche problems. So I think that the danger will be low and then probably elevate towards moderate tomorrow with the new snow, but then probably reach towards considerable with those strong winds out of the east. So stay tuned on that. In the meantime, should be pretty mellow and benign conditions in the backcountry today.
Okay, Drew, thanks.
Hey, thanks.
Coming up on the local news hour in just a few minutes. I'll be checking in with Summit County Manager Shane Scott. We'll be taking a look at the agenda for Wednesday's County Council meeting. Later on, KPCW General Manager Renee Bodley and Development Director Sarah Irvin recapping the Winter Pledge Drive. And finally, People's Health Clinic Women's Health Medical Director Dr. Tanya Bonar highlighting the comprehensive outpatient OBGYN care that the clinic provides. Taking a look at some local news now, Park City Mountain owner Vail Resorts reported a decrease in skier visits in the company's quarterly earnings report yesterday. KPCW's Parker Malatesta reports that executives are blaming low snow.
Through March 3rd, visits to Vail's 37 resorts in North America are down 9.7% compared to last winter. During an earnings call with investors Monday, Vail Resorts Chief Executive Officer Kirsten Lynch said snowfall at its mountains on the western edge of the U.S. was roughly 42% below last winter's totals through January. Lynch also said resorts in the east and Midwest struggled with limited natural snow and variable temperatures. Chief Financial Officer Angela Korch said those conditions resulted in fewer visitors on the mountain.
Across our North American resorts, unfavorable conditions negatively impacted season-to-date visitation, which was below both prior year levels and our expectations, based on the number of guests visiting and their frequency. Following the Martin Luther King Jr. holiday weekend, challenging conditions persisted until early March at Whistler Blackcomb and our Tahoe resorts. And while conditions improved at our Rockies and Eastern resorts, visitation did not improve as quickly as expected.
Despite the decrease in visitation, lift revenue was up slightly for the quarter, which Lynch attributed to strong Epic Pass sales. Vail's ancillary businesses, which include ski school, dining, and rentals, are experiencing growth in spending. Still, the company plans to lower its guidance after falling short of expectations. Vail Resorts stock dipped about 6% in after-hours trading following the quarterly report. During Monday's call, the CEO commented on Alterra Mountain Company's recent purchase of Arapaho Basin in Colorado.
It makes a lot of sense to us that Alterra appears to be pursuing a strategy that might be more similar to our strategy of an owned and operated model.
Despite recent purchases, Deer Valley owner and Icon Pass distributor Alterra is far behind Vail Resorts, which owns 41 ski areas worldwide. Vail's acquisition of Swiss resort Crans-Montana is expected to close this spring, pushing the total to 42. When Alterra's purchase of A Basin is complete, the firm's portfolio will grow to 18 mountains. Parker Malatesta, KPCW News.
The Summit County Council meets tomorrow, starting at 4:30 at the County Courthouse in Colville. In the studio now with a preview, I have County Manager Shane Scott. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
A pretty lightweight agenda, but looks like the county is finally done with its appeals to the Board of Equalization.
Yes, one of our latest starts that I can remember, 4:30, so we're not complaining, I guess, about that. But yes, it's been quite a haul this year getting through those. We've had to ask for two extensions in those appeals, but I think we're seeing the light at the end of the tunnel.
Okay, so how did that all fall out? I mean, any idea? Were most of the appeals granted or split?
I actually don't know. But I talked to Cindy about our county auditor about the delay, and of course she's we hired a new person. We did everything we could, and I think you saw the numbers. I think we're in the 4,000 range last time I heard of appeals, more than Salt Lake County, which is obviously much bigger than us. So she's done a great job, and I think a lot of the appeals were upheld, actually, were not granted the changes. I think there was a lot of justification for those different values, and I think a lot of the appeals were upheld.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, to have had a successful appeal, I mean, what did a property owner need to prove or show?
It's not easy. I knew of one individual that had just gone through an appraisal of their home, and so they were able to present that as justification for their appeal, and I think they did have that lowered somewhat, but the data is the data, and unless you do have something like that, or if you're willing to go through the process of getting an appraisal, which isn't inexpensive, it can be a challenging thing it's really just sticker shock. You just can't believe that your home is worth that, and I think once the data is presented, you can see that it might really be.
Yeah, you know, and people often complain about, or, you know, it's like, oh, that's going to hurt my property values. In this case, we need something like that.
Yeah, right. Yeah. We're not hoping for the Great Recession to return, but sure is nice to have a little bit of a course correction.
Yeah. Also, a discussion of an amendment to the flowchart for the assessor office. What's changing there?
Stephanie, our county assessor, is looking for an opportunity with a person that has just resigned, and she's just looking at that and evaluating her office and saying, I could actually use a person in a different area. I think she's looking for a condo appraiser as opposed to the person that's leaving. So she's asking for just a change of the chart of accounts. So it's not a new person, it's just a change of a position. It will cost a little bit more, but she's also doing some juggling around and timing to make it a budget neutral a change. So I appreciate anybody looking at those opportunities to do things differently. And I'm actually doing that right now in our community development department. We're losing Pat in August, and we're looking at, are there ways that we can think outside the box here and do something different or better? He's left the department so rich with talent and skill that we've got a lot of opportunities there too. So I'm excited about what Stephanie's got to present.
Okay, well, let's talk a little bit about Pat. So, I mean, have you looked at, you know, his replacement at this point?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, everything's on the table and no decisions have been made. I've actually been just starting to have some conversations with council members in more of a just a casual fashion about what they might want to see with a new community development director. But like I said, we've got such a embarrassment of riches when it comes to talent in that department that we're just trying to kind of think outside the box. We have some situations in our county where I would love to do anything I can to break down walls. We're so spread out geographically, and so sometimes we can all get siloed. So that's always in the back of my mind, in the back of Jenny Young's mind as well, is how can we break down silos? And so is there an opportunity here? And just Pat, I mean, if you think about Pat Putt, what he's meant to our county, what he's meant to our community, he's irreplaceable. We cannot replace Pat Putt. We can't look for Pat Putt 2.0. So what can we bring in here that's going to continue that legacy and move us forward?
Yeah, so is that your thought, though, that you do have a new community development director, or do you even just look at bringing on a senior planner or a planning director?
We always look first internally to make sure that we have the talent to, and by statute, we need a community development director. Community development director serves as a, in certain ways in our code, as a administrative decision maker. So we actually have to have that person by title. But, you know, is there something else we can do? And do we need to put this out and do a nationwide search? Or is there somebody we can count on internally? And what's the makeup of that? Are we a top-down structure? Can we be a little bit maybe more horizontal in how we're approaching this? So kind of everything's on the table. And just want to make sure, we may just replace somebody, just replace Pat and say, here's our new person. Here's the new Pat. Here they are. And it'll be exactly the same. But we want to make sure that we have that opportunity to look at things in a holistic manner.
So I think his plan is to leave by August 1, correct?
Yes.
And that's still what you're working towards?
Yes, that is. So it's actually right the last couple of weeks we've been having these conversations.
All right. Let's see. The council also scheduled Wednesday to appoint a member to the North Summit Fire Service District Administrative Control Board. And I also noticed like a resolution. Does it require a resolution to change members?
Yes, it does. That is new. I think that was new for us last year. And not every board does require that, but certain boards do, and this is one of them. And so it has been a little clunky as we've kind of walk through that. So usually they'll do the interviews 1 week and then they'll do the appointment the next just because they create the resolution. So,
all right. And then finally on the agenda, a public hearing on a special exception request for Randall Brothers Construction to grade the first 20 feet of a driveway in Promontory to 8%. I think the limit is 5%, and that is because as a vehicle is approaching the roadway, you want to make sure that they're not on a steep hill.
That's right. 5% is the current code, and of course, I think that's weather related too. We don't want to be on a steep hill with weather. But if you those that read the report will see that we do have areas in our community that are 15%, and we haven't seen a rash of crashes or incidents. So the 8% is probably not a tremendous ask. They are also providing a heated driveway, which would also then limit the amount of ice on that. So it still meets American with Disabilities Act guidelines. So the staff's taken a neutral position on this, but I think it has a lot of merit if you read the staff report.
All right. I know the council does not like special exemptions, and this would be one of the reasons why it's like, well, they got it. How come I can't?
Right. It is. It's not a good practice to be in, and of course, your exception should always be proving your rule. So if we have a code that needs to be changed, we should change it. But I think in this case, the code's pretty solid, and the exception might make some sense.
It sounds like the driveway's already built. Are they kind of asking for forgiveness?
Oh, I don't know about that.
Okay.
I don't know about that.
All right. And then finally, I wanted to mention that you've got some new information with regard to the West Hills potential incorporation. What's happening?
Well, we're just rolling out some. Our communications department is actually going to roll this out later today. It's just a little bit of a frequently asked question, just a kind of some facts. I went to the Ure Ranch open house, the first one, and I was asked much more about West Hills than I was about the Ure Ranch. And so I think the council is getting a lot of questions. I think there's some criticism about why we're not speaking out more and taking more positions. So this little fact sheet will kind of address that. I can give you a couple of highlights if that's okay. We have property owners have until March 13th, which is tomorrow, to file an exclusion for their property to not be part of the incorporation. Summit County has an option to purchase the Ure Ranch, but we don't own the Ure Ranch yet, so we cannot choose to exclude the Ure Ranch property. Only registered voters in the boundary can vote to incorporate, so we don't have a vote. Summit County does not have a vote. Summit County does not approve or deny the incorporation. We don't have jurisdiction over that. We don't have jurisdiction over the feasibility study. We were able to make comments once the feasibility study was presented, and we had some concerns with it, and those comments we can make public as well, but we don't have yay or nay up and down votes of the feasibility study, and we don't get a vote for or against the incorporation at all. So we're just trying to provide facts, trying to provide data, and let individuals especially know what we can and cannot do as a county.
Yeah. Could the Ures file an exclusion to be included?
They could. They would be able to. They had a negotiation with another party, and in that negotiation they committed to not removing themselves from that West Hills incorporation. So.
Okay.
But anyone that lives in that boundary that is a registered voter is able to vote to incorporate or not incorporate.
Okay. And then what's the next step? I mean, they'll consider then after tomorrow whether or not they still have a viable.
Yes, I think we'll know. Maybe we won't know tomorrow, but we should know soon after tomorrow how many were excluded. And if it continues to go to a vote, they'll vote as part of our general election. They have had one public hearing that they are required to do, and I think they have to have at least one more.
Yeah. So can an incorporation just be in the middle of nowhere? I mean, just to put it bluntly, I mean, does it have to touch anything else to be incorporated, or
no? And I guess just speaking generally, that feasibility study is supposed to pick up on any of the concerns they might have, from infrastructure to taxes to are they able to financially support themselves. And this feasibility study went through that process and did say that it was a feasible incorporation. One can read it and disagree with that very easily. And of course, like I said, we as county staff put together a response to the feasibility study, because the county is involved whether we incorporate or not. There was parts of that feasibility study that addressed the county providing services, so we would. I don't know if that obligates to provide service. I would argue with you it does not. But that's what the feasibility of the incorporation would be, is providing sheriff's services to this new city, where that is actually their responsibility. So there'll be, even if incorporation goes through, there'll be a lot of conversations around how feasible is this incorporation, and what is the county's role in that.
Yeah, and I recall years ago, because there had been some talk about why doesn't the Snyderville Basin incorporate, right? Because they've got the residential, but they also have the commercial, which, again, helps pay the tax bills.
Right.
But it just seemed like it was too difficult to do that. How was this different?
Well, I think it is much easier starting from scratch. We would have to unwind special service districts. We're so far down this road in the basin that I can't imagine going backwards. It's maybe something that is talked about every few years and probably could happen. But Ben, you're right. We'd have that base. We'd have an instant income and revenue source to provide these services that we need to. But with a brand new community, you start from scratch. They'd have to elect a mayor and council. They'd have to go through all the issues of starting a new community. And the most challenging, I think, would be the financial piece of development. Well, counting on development for their tax base is really a challenging thing, where in the basin they'd already have that.
And a good example of that is Hideout, right? I mean, that's exactly what we saw happen there. It was like the property owner couldn't get what he wanted with the county, so it's like, okay, managed to get some legislation adopted that allowed him to incorporate, and he had like a month to do it. It was really quite strange. Anyway, he's got it, but it's not working. And now they're coming back and trying to annex are there rules now in place to ensure the incorporation does what it's supposed to?
And in theory, that's what the process should do. The process should vet out whether this is a feasible opportunity. And if it isn't, which if you read the feasibility study, and I'm giving you my opinion, this isn't the opinion of Summit County or any council member, but that feasibility study has some real challenges, there are some assumptions there that are taking a really it really pie in the sky, in my opinion, and it's so important that those assumptions take place for that to be a feasible city. It's just, to me, doesn't meet the feasibility standard that I have, and so in theory, this process should vet that out. And if it doesn't do that, I guess what's the purpose of the process? Because there have been, like the Hideout example, others where they didn't have to go through a feasibility study, they didn't have to go through a process. They could incorporate much easier, and I think we've seen some of the fruits of those situations, which haven't always been great.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention, Shane?
I think that's all.
Okay. Thanks for your time.
Have a wonderful day. Thanks.
That's Summit County Manager Shane Scott. Well, as we reported, KPCW finished out its best winter pledge drive ever. In the studio with details, I have KPCW General Manager Renee Bodley, along with Development Director Sarah Irvin. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie.
I know it's always a stressful month, kind of leading up to the drive, and then we've got the drive itself, and it might sound fun and easy on air, but it's not. Have you both recovered?
Yes, I think I've recovered. Sarah, how about you?
Well, the combination of the pledge drive and then you throw in the time change, I have not yet recovered.
Yeah, everybody was a little groggy yesterday around the station, that's for sure.
Okay, so let's get then the total after adding everything up through Sunday night.
We arrived, yes, we were counting donations online through midnight on Sunday, and as of Monday morning, our total came to $309,120, so a little over $309,000.
Okay, and as I said, it was the best winter drive.
Yes.
Yeah.
So summers do better?
Summers do a little bit better. Our highest summer pledge drive is $351,000. That was right after the Parley's Canyon wildfire, and the community really rallied and showed their support for the station. I think last summer, Sarah, we were at 320-ish.
I think we were maybe closer to 330, but yes, summers do typically do better. I think part of that is that as far as some of our giveaways go, you know, we always are saying that we have these fantastic premiums to offer donors when they give to KPCW. We'll give them a gift back. During the summer, we have winter lift tickets at a higher, I guess, quantity than we do during the winter drive. So that is something I think people really do respond to.
Yeah, and along those lines, Leslie, we always get phone calls during the pledge drive from businesses saying, oh, I have something I want to donate. And, you know, thank you very much. But when we're in the thick of pledge drive, that's a little too late. So we do our pledge drives every March and every August. And if you have a business in town and you'd like to donate something to our pledge drive that we can then in turn give to our donors as a thank you gift, really about a month or two before our pledge drives.
I'd say at least 2 to 3 months before we'll start.
But you cut it off. Yeah.
A month. Yes. Before. Yeah. We have a deadline that's typically about 10 days before the pledge drive starts, because we have to inventory everything. We have to account for it. We need to know the value as far as, you know, what the recipient will receive, and then also just be able to track what we have.
So it's not your typical get a tote bag or a coffee mug. We really celebrate local businesses as well as celebrating local nonprofits who come in and help us raise money. And then, of course, we're celebrating public radio.
We do need a coffee mug, though, with a new logo.
I think we need some new station swag just because people do like it.
They do. And you know what? Thank you so much, Bruce Larrabee, who always donated those beautiful coffee mugs, and now he's retired. So you're right. We need new coffee mugs. Duly noted.
And if you happen to have a KPCW Bruce Larrabee mug out there.
Collector item.
Yeah, exactly.
So while the total pledge amount was up, the number of donors didn't hit your self-selected mark of 1,000 unique donors. I think just over 800?
Just over 900, oh, Leslie. Okay. And we were looking for 1,000 donations. And that is where we fell short, this pledge drive. We are very happy to raise the amount of money that we did, but the whole idea behind public radio is community support, and we want to get more people feeling like they can get involved in this radio station and become sustainers. And by sustainers, I mean, think of it like maybe a subscription. Everything we do for free. You can go on our website for free. There's no paywall. You can sign up and get our daily email newsletter for free. You listen to the radio for free. You know, we're not serious radio. You don't have to pay a subscription. So, you know, is that maybe worth $5 a month to you? Maybe you make an annual donation of $60. You know, very few people who actually consume public radio end up donating to public radio. And our goal was really to raise that bar, and we did fall a little short.
When you look at 900 plus, I mean, what does that represent in terms of possible listeners?
Well, we did the quick math before the pledge drive, and if you just take the full-time resident population of Summit and Wasatch County, let's say it's roughly 80,000, we were looking to hit 1.25% of that population, getting us to 1,000. So we did fall a little short of that. And, you know, we have a lot of second homeowners in the area who also are very supportive of KPCW, and we obviously deeply appreciate that. You know, they listen when they are away in their primary residence and want to know, is it snowing here? Should we head out this weekend? What are we getting ourselves into? And so we appreciate the support from the second homeowners as well.
Yeah, and I got to say, it's not that you're just within the listening area, because you can listen from anywhere in the world as long as you've got, you know, Wi-Fi or internet. And so, what is it? Why don't people donate? Any reasons?
You know, it's a great question, Leslie. I don't know if there's some impediment that we're unaware of. You know, I think it's relatively easy to get online and click that donate button. We don't do anything with your information. Your information stays here. Maybe sometimes people are a little skittish about, are you going to sell my email address? Heavens no. We've got very strict policies here that donor information, as far as contact information, is private. However, we do have a donor transparency policy here. Anyone who gives $5,000 or more to the station, we are going to make your name public on our website. That's just because we're a local news organization and we feel like that transparency is very important.
All right. During the pledge drives, we offer all of the various nonprofits an hour to come in. If they do well and get their supporters to come on board with them, then they receive some sort of free underwriting. How did that work? Did everybody hit the mark?
You know, almost everybody hit their goal as far as the goals that we'd set for the hour and the goal of maxing out the free underwriting that we are able to offer. We offer up to 100 free spots of underwriting. It equates to about $4,000 in free underwriting credit that an eligible nonprofit can earn. Now, when I say eligible, it has to be a registered 501c3. We do have a few 501c4s in the area, and they are not eligible for the free underwriting, but any registered 501c3 operating in and serving residents of Summit and Wasatch counties are invited to participate with us in pledge drives. And I think this time, we're with the math that we're running, we will be offering about $75,000 in free underwriting credit to 20 nonprofits that participated with us. So we're very excited about that. They use that credit over the next 6 months. So when they have upcoming events or programs that they're launching, any reason that they would want to come in and record an underwriting spot. And of course, for anyone who doesn't know, underwriting is the public radio term for advertising. And so it saves them marketing money in the long run.
So do you see this format? I mean, is it sustainable? Do you have the nonprofits who are willing to be part of the drives year after year?
We do. And in fact, just like we have local businesses that listen and want to donate premium items. We had a couple of nonprofits reach out while we were midway through the drive saying, hey, do you have any open hours? The answer was no at the time, but we'd love to invite any interested nonprofits who want to learn more. Reach out to me. I'm Sarah, S-A-R-A-H, at kpcw.org. Reach out to me now and we can talk about the August drive. A lot of also organizations kind of think about when would they want that free underwriting credit? When is it most valuable to them? Some organizations really like to promote their summer programs, so they like to come on during the winter drive and earn that credit. Others have, you know, a robust winter and they want to earn the credit during the summer.
Okay. And those nonprofits, if they bring in a for-profit sponsor to sponsor their hour, the minimum level is $1,000, but that gets them that much closer mm-hmm. to raising the $5,000 for the hour. Want to give a quick shout out to the gold sponsors. These are folks who donated $2,500 or more to sponsor an hour. That's Park City Mountain, Epic Promise, Deer Valley Resort, High Star Ranch, Promontory Foundation, and Gallagher Pediatrics. Thanks, you guys, for being gold sponsors.
Great. All right. Anything else you want to mention with the pledge drive?
Sarah? No. If anyone's out there who donated waiting for their premiums to arrive in the mail along with their tax letters, Ethel and her team of trusty volunteers, they have been working around the clock. A lot of those got mailed out the day after a donation was made, and you should be receiving those any minute. But I'd say give it this week, and if you haven't received something from us, feel free to reach out.
And shout out to Ethel and her team. Oh, and yes. This was Ethel's last pledge drive. We had our second to last hour of the pledge drive honored Ethel. And she got so many great comments and people calling in. It was wonderful.
Yeah, it sure was. Finally, then, Renee, I wanted to let you have a few minutes here. The news was announced to the staff and board of directors on Friday that you're leaving the station. So tell us about your decision.
Yes, after 7 years of being general manager, I am leaving and I'm heading back home to Roanoke, Virginia. I'm going to be the new chief advancement officer at WVTF, a public radio station right down the street from my parents' home.
So you grew up here then, in Roanoke?
I grew up in Roanoke, yeah. I've lived in Utah for almost the past 30 years, 10 of which up here in Park City, and had a great run in local news. I was at Fox 13 for 19 years, then came up here, and really have enjoyed my time here at the station and in the community. But it's time. It's time to go home.
Yeah. So when are you leaving?
I start the new job at the end of May. When I'm actually physically leaving Park City remains to be seen. But I'm excited to start this new chapter. I'm excited to focus on just fundraising for public radio. You know, when you sit in the general manager's office, you wear a programming hat, a news hat, a fundraising hat, and an HR hat. And I'm very happy to just be able to focus solely on fundraising. And this station covers all of Western Virginia, and ironically enough, I'm a University of Virginia graduate, but with this station, it's licensed to Virginia Tech, so I'll technically be a Virginia Tech employee, so I'm joining the Hokie Nation.
Yeah, so how does a chief advancement officer compare to, say, what Sarah does, development director?
Kind of the same thing. It's a new program, a new model that they've put in place at Virginia Tech, and it's kind of under the advancement office's alumni relations and communications and marketing and also fundraising. And so it's all of various schools and units of Virginia Tech have an advancement officer. And since the radio station, while it's in Roanoke and Tech is in Blacksburg, it's owned by the Virginia Tech Foundation, the radio station is. So they have, they're more of an NPR traditional station, kind of like KUER. They do have a great local news department, though, which really kind of sings to my soul. I like working with local news. They won a couple of Murrow Awards, which is, you know, a highly esteemed honor in the journalism world. So I'm excited to help them kind of trumpet the work that they do in terms of local news. They also have a classical music station. And what can I say? I played flute in the Roanoke Youth Symphony growing up, so I've got classical music in my DNA as well, and it's going to be fun working with them.
Well, you totally missed the opportunity to do an hour on your behalf, on your retirement.
You know, Ethel's leaving us, and, you know, Jennifer Bailey, who manages our Broadcasters Club, she's leaving us too. And it just seems like a good time to have a new general manager come in. I've had such a great community here, such a great group of friends. But, you know, I've experienced a lot of personal loss over the past several months, and that puts things in perspective, and you realize that nothing replaces family. And, you know, I'm also keeping the door open to returning to Park City at some point. There's so much happening here. The Olympics coming in 10 years, and this also feels I've created a home here as well. Maybe I'll be coming back.
Yeah. So what's the process for your replacement?
We're going to meet with the Board of Trustees this Thursday. We have our monthly meeting scheduled. We'll go into closed session to discuss that. I'm sure there will be a national search. There was a national search in 2017 when I was lucky enough to get this job. I'm sure the board's going to want to make sure they find the absolute best person to be the general manager here. I think it's important that whomever they find has a healthy respect for the uniqueness of this station within the public radio universe. There are very few public radio stations that have such a great local news department and plays AAA music. Mm-hmm. You know, most of them do NPR talk all the time. Like, we don't do All Things Considered. We have Randy Barton. It's really important that whoever replaces me, I think, really understands and respects that legacy.
Okay, so we don't have a job description out there, a posting at this point?
Nothing yet. It should be up before the end of this week.
Okay, and then your last day at KPCW is when?
We're not sure yet. Okay. That's something we have to, I have to start the new job May 20th. I've told them that. They needed a start date for the offer letter, and that's what we decided on. So my last day here is yet to be determined.
Okay. All right. Anything else?
No. Thank you, everyone who donated during our winter pledge drive. Thank you, everyone who has supported me personally. I'm really going to miss everyone here.
Okay. Renee Bodley and Sarah Irvin, thank you. Dr. Tanya Bodnar has been with the People's Health Clinic as an obstetrician and gynecologist since 2018. In 2022, she was named as the clinic's Women's Health Medical Director. She joins me now in studio. Good morning.
Good morning, Leslie. It's so wonderful to be here.
Yeah, so has this become a full-time job or is it still a part-time position?
So it's, full-time in my heart. It is part-time hourly. But yes, as the Women's Health Medical Director, I oversee and I lead this newly created Women's Health Department. It really focuses on comprehensive outpatient care, both obstetrics and gynecology. So prenatal care, pregnancy-related, and gynecology when you're not pregnant.
All right, so are you a practicing OBGYN at the clinic, or do you oversee then the program?
So I'm so lucky that I get to do both. I still have clinical hours. I still see patients in clinic and very much am hands-on, which I love and it's great to be part of. And then I also do part of my position is to oversee both volunteer and contracted, both staff, physicians, and caregivers. So I do want to take this chance now to give a little bit of a shout out to the team, because it's just an amazing group of people. Rochelle Flynn, who's the assistant medical director of the clinic, she's our physician's assistant. We also have Elizabeth Jacobson, our women's health nurse practitioner. She's the assistant women's health medical director. And then we have a rock star team of certified nurse midwives who come to us from the IMC midwifery program. That's Annette Johnson, Jennifer Raleigh, Lindsay German, and they help us with our prenatal care, our lower risk patients, and they're just really invaluable. And then we have our volunteer providers. It is the mission of the clinic to really be run by volunteer providers, and we have three exceptional physicians. Dr. Merrill Lewin, a previous board member, really was a big supporter of this role for me and has been a mentor. Dr. Catherine Arbabi, who's also a physician who lives here in the community, and Dr. Michael Darter, who comes from the East Coast, retired from fertility services and has found a little niche here in Park City and just wants to give back. So it's a great team.
All right. So when we talk about what the center provides to the women patients at the clinic, I mean, it's, again, the prenatal care and, of course, taking them through their pregnancy, but then just something standard that you would walk into a gynecologist's office for as well?
Definitely. So we do obstetric care, and I do want to get back to that because I want to talk about our great partnership that we have with Intermountain Health, but we also do gynecologic care, and that is non-pregnant. You're just coming in for what we call a well woman visit or a gynecologic problem, and that is a big spectrum of care as well. So general health maintenance recommendations, keeping you healthy, cancer screening, breast cancer, cervical cancer, colon cancer, making sure you're up to date with all of those tests. We do a fair amount of depression and domestic violence screening, and we have lots of community partners that that then we can refer to. Contraception counseling and management, so we offer free same-day birth control. Something else I really want to talk about, because that's really where the need for funding is being felt recently. We want to be able to put in an intrauterine device or put in an implant same day, right when a woman walks in.
All right. So it sounds like you, but you also treat women outside of their reproductive years.
Oh, yeah. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And then we also offer STD or STI screening mm-hmm. treatment, both patients and their partners. So it's really very comprehensive. It's, as you said, reproductive years, pregnancy related, but also not.
Yeah, yeah. You know, and I know that much of the clinic's population is Latina, right? Catholic, and which I believe still doesn't condone artificial contraception. How does that impact then the family planning issues?
You know, I really don't even look at it that way. I look at medical care. I look at what is right for every woman, every family, every patient. And I talk to everybody the same way. I offer all the services to everybody. And really the message is about education, really talking about how an unplanned and unwanted pregnancy is really can be so devastating to patients who weren't ready for that, and trying to have them look ahead and realize that using condoms, using birth control pills, having an implant, having something so that they have a voice and a choice about their future is really the message that we try to always be focusing on. So I don't really look at, I mean, I look at the population and I look at our Latina women and families, but I don't let religion sort of get in the way of what we're offering. It's truly medical.
Yeah. And then you mentioned same day contraception. How does that work?
So patients are scheduled for an appointment many times, and we see this in private practice as well. Patients know what they want, and they come in and they say, I want some pills, or I want an IUD, and sometimes they don't know. So we really start from the beginning with everybody, even if they come in saying, hey, I'd love to start a pack of pills, or I'd love a Nexplanon in my arm, and we make sure that that's the right option for them, and then it happens same day, right on the spot. And that is also due to the ability of having those products, devices in the clinic. So we will send out women with a whole year supply of birth control pills, or we will place an intrauterine device right then and there in the clinic, or an implant in their arm, if we have the devices available. And birth control is not cheap, and we do everything for free. So this is really sort of a call out to anyone who's feeling generous, anyone who's wanting to give back, if you want to call the clinic or you want to jump online and make a donation, it can be for general operational expenses, or it can be earmarked for specifically women's health, contraception, birth control.
Yeah, so didn't the pills, though, just become over-the-counter at this point?
So there are over-the-counter options. This is a progesterone-only option. A combined oral contraception includes estrogen and progesterone, and there has been a little hesitation in getting that out just because there can be some contraindications for some patients. But a progesterone-only birth control pill is a great option to get started, for sure. We do know that it's maybe not as effective as the combined oral contraceptive. We call them COCs. And certainly an IUD or an Nexplanon, an implant in the arm, offers long-acting reversible contraception. So 8 years, 10 years, 12 years, or maybe just enough time after you had your baby and you're not really sure what's going on, you don't want to get pregnant right away. The average age of or length of time of keeping in a LARC, L-A-R-C, is about 2.5 years for these women after having one baby and not quite ready for their next. So we have options, and we want to be able to give all of those to our patients.
All right. So you're busy. We see a lot of people.
We're busy. We're busy, and that's why it's so important that we have this big team. We all kind of focus on our can I say specialties, right? Our midwives are super influential and helpful with seeing our low-risk prenatal patients. Rochelle and Elizabeth are awesome in seeing lots of women's health preventative care services. They also help with new OB patients. We all have our place sort of in what we're doing. I want to touch upon something wonderful that we've brought along in the last year, and this is our cervical dysplasia program. So that's when a pap smear comes back abnormal, and then they need to be referred for a procedure to see if they truly have signs of precancerous lesions. So a year ago at our Walk and Wine gala in the summer, it was kind of an overwhelming moment for me when a whole table raised their hand and offered to donate a brand new colposcope, which is the instrument that I use, the machinery that I use to be able to perform this procedure. And they offered to purchase a new LEAP machine, and that is also a curative procedure for abnormal PAPs. It was just really a moment where generosity takes over, and that's what's so amazing about this community in Park City. So we have done more than 50 colposcopies, which is incredible. They're not cheap if they're done out in private practice, and I think I know that offering these services for free in the clinic really help with the equity piece of medicine. Women don't feel like they can pay for things, or then they're going to be left with a big bill, or they just don't go. They don't go and have these procedures done. So I really wanted to highlight that due to the generosity of the public and due to this community, we can offer these services. And I'm thrilled that I have the skills to be able to perform them. And my staff, my medical assistants, again, shout out to Steve Quesada, who's just an incredible medical assistant, and Sarah Thompson. We've been doing them, and we've been doing them a lot, and it's been really beneficial.
Yeah. How many patients do you see every year?
So I am contracted certain hours weekly, and I kind of split my time between the clinical work. So I see patients for one full day a week, and really we bring them in. Even if there's no spots, even if I'm double booked or triple booked, it's fine. We stay until the last patient is seen. So I've seen close to 700 appointments in 2023, and that's seeing patients one day in clinic. And then the rest of my time is doing sort of oversight, managing, coordinating care. This is where our relationship with Intermountain Health is so incredible and instrumental. 57% of our patients are delivering on the Wasatch. I'm sorry, I have my numbers wrong. 76% of our patients are delivering on the Wasatch back in an Intermountain facility, specifically 57% at Park City Hospital. So we have a great relationship, and important to know that patients have choice of where to go and where to deliver, and they choose to stay at a community hospital because of the extraordinary level of care that is being offered, but also because they're getting compassionate care, and they feel like they belong, and they feel like they are safe, and that's really an important part to this vulnerable population.
Yeah, and real quick then, besides just the opportunity to deliver a child at an Intermountain healthcare provider, what else do they help you with?
So they are instrumental, as I said, our midwives from IMC, our Intermountain Medical Center, are part of Intermountain, and they also give us radiology, imaging, ultrasounds, laboratory care, and we also have a great relationship with the IBCLC nurses at Park City Hospital. Those are the lactation consultants who come down and offer services to our patients, and they really feel like they're getting everything. They're getting everything that everybody else, any other woman, is receiving.
Okay, and in terms of just the Roe v. Wade, which was overturned, how is that impacting your practice?
Well, so Roe v. Wade was overturned a bit ago, obviously, and this marked a historic catastrophe, really kind of a return to the dark ages for women in this country. But in Utah, there was a court injunction which was issued immediately sort of after the trigger law was about to take effect, and really... It would have ended almost all abortion care in Utah. And this injunction is still in place while litigation continues. Our partners in Planned Parenthood of Utah have really been forging through. So right now, it is still legal to have a termination, to have an abortion up to 18 weeks of pregnancy. And we certainly support our patients who choose to have this service. And we work with our partners in Salt Lake who are performing the services down there.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to mention?
Just want to say I'm super proud to be part of this amazing organization. I'm so thankful for the board of People's Health Clinic, for Mari Lining, our CEO, who just has a vision. We are a family, and we're all in this mission together because here we care. Aquí nos importa. That is our logo.
Okay.
Thanks, Leslie.
Dr. Tanya Bodnar, thanks.